What's up, Dune fans? Welcome back to the Dune Not Enter podcast, where today we find out where all this spice is going. I'm your host, Humphrey Hsu, and joining me are my friends and co-hosts, Fillmore John.
Hey, guys.
And Nolan Zhang.
Welcome back, everyone.
Indeed. Welcome back, everyone. This is episode, I believe, 37 of the Dune Not Enter podcast. Today we'll be going over chapter 32. We will be going over the chapter in its entirety. So this is a very exciting chapter, so I'm really looking forward to the discussion. But is there anything new that you guys have done this week that you might want to update us listeners about?
So I have like this old helicopter in the back of my, like toy RC helicopter in the back of my closet, and I finally dug it up because I'm probably going to do like a physics IA project on it. Uh-huh. And when I took it out, I didn't have the antenna on the remote control, so I ordered it from Amazon yesterday. And Amazon's a really good support system because they said, they gave me like a voicemail saying they dropped it off. I went outside to look, it wasn't there, and I called them and they were really nice about it. So they said it would arrive tonight, so I'm going to check outside once the podcast is finished recording.
That's very cool.
Honestly, I'm kind of like suspicious about those helicopters because they break so easily, but yeah, I wish you luck.
I remember those drones, not necessarily a helicopter, but one of the drones. I was watching some YouTube video. He was recording some college campus overview, and then he lost the drone on top of the clock tower because the signal got too far. So that was really funny. So he had to stop his college like recording video, and he said he lost motivation after he lost his drone on top of the tower. He was like, if anyone wants to climb up the clock tower and get it, it's yours.
Must have been an expensive drone.
It probably was like a few hundred dollars. Those things are really expensive.
Don't come cheap.
Really interesting to hear. Well, let's dive right into this chapter. So it's rather short and sweet epigraph today, but Nolan, go ahead.
Okay, so the epigraph goes, the Fremen were supreme in that quality the ancients called Spenningsbogen, which is the self-imposed delay between desire for a thing and the act of reaching out to grasp that thing, from the wisdom of Muad'Dib by the Princess Irulan. Okay, so Herbert is like whipping out his linguistical skills and introducing us to this word, Spenningsbogen, which he describes as basically having self-control over oneself so that you have the patience needed to obtain one's desire. Mm-hmm. So interestingly enough, this isn't actually a Dune original word. It's actually a German word that means suspense. And I don't know, because it's quite perplexing since I don't think we've seen German in this book till now. And I'm just not really sure why he is introducing a German word this late into the halfway through the book and in the epigraph too. Do you have any ideas for that?
I want to say, Nolan, you taking German paid off.
Yeah,
I know.
Spenningsbogen, right, indeed. Is that how you actually would pronounce it, or?
Yeah, Spenningsbogen.
Spenningsbogen. Cool. That's fun to say. Yeah, but probably I believe Herbert is still integrating various earthly cultures into his story to make it seem more of a thing set far in the future and make it more believable. Although language changes so much over a few hundred years, let alone, the 10,000 years that's passed in this book. So I'm surprised the word would still exist in its form at all that's even comprehensible. But,
yeah, I know. It's pretty similar.
Yes, and also the Arabic and, of course, all the other stuff that we'll see and we've seen. Mm-hmm. It's still very similar. And, if we go back to 1200s old English or 800s old English, the language is nearly unrecognizable. Yeah, so it's really interesting.
Bro, old English is so hard to read.
Yeah, I tried reading Beowulf in old English. It's not.
Oh my god. Do not attempt it.
Don't attempt.
Don't recommend.
Or some other, I don't remember, but it's definitely some old English is not easy on the reader. Right. So let's do the quote section before we start. So I'll explain the quote section. Essentially, every week we pick a few of our quotes, our favorite quotes from the chapter, and we put them at the beginning of the episode, and we read them and we'll discuss them as they come up in the chapter chronologically. So as usual, Fillmore, you have the first quote.
Okay. As for my quote this week, I chose, "They grow," he said, "but the slow way is the safe way."
Very good.
Very interesting.
Don't take that out of context, though.
No, not at all. So my quote was, "A leader, you see, is one of the things that distinguishes a mob from a people. He maintains the level of individuals. Too few individuals, and a people reverts to a mob." Yep.
Mm, I agree.
Very
mobs are scary.
Yep.
Uh-huh. So for my quote, I chose, "I must suppress such longings," she thought, They're a weakness. I no longer can afford weaknesses.
Yeah, definitely. She can't afford anything, let alone weaknesses. Yeah, so.
She can't even afford water, guys.
Mm-hmm. Right.
I mean, we can't afford 1 gram of spice either. So.
Yeah.
That's true.
Yeah, sell my mortgage my house. You know, that's how. Yeah.
Okay, so remember how like a couple of chapters ago we were talking about how Herbert is like using the experiences of Paul and Jessica traversing through the desert for character growth? Mm-hmm. Well, like to be honest, I think we did discuss how like the events technically have very little effect on the main plot of the story. And here at this beginning of this chapter, we get an example of Herbert not using this scenarios, because here we see Herbert didn't write about how the Fremen and Herbert, I mean, not Herbert, and Paul and Jessica got to the Cave of Ridges, meaning that the pace is inside the book is speeding up, and I'm pretty sure I could expect some extra space and wording to be used for something even more important and more exciting than just like character growth of Jessica and Paul.
Right. Yeah, it's nicer to be moving into action more and more as we see. I think there's more interesting things recently. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Well, I think at the same time, it shows a sense of security with the Fremen because it means that nothing notable happened on their way to the cave.
Right, yeah.
Wow,
because,
actually, that's a pretty good way of thinking. Yeah.
Right,
yeah.
Because there was a lot of notable things that happened on their way to the basin, right? That earlier when they were crossing yeah. the sands, and
they lost their package. They got chased by worms.
I know. So they just can't seem to stay out of danger. You know, that's why Chani is a good influence for Paul. I mean,
mm-hmm. I know, right, guy?
In multiple ways.
Okay,
indeed.
Yeah. So here, mm-hmm. Paul brings up another interesting word. So he brings up the word Sirat from. He brings
Sirat?
Up the word Sirat, and he reads some words. Sirat? Yeah, Sirat.
Probably.
Sirat, yeah. Sirat. So he utters some words from the Sirat. I mean, I'm sorry, guys.
Okay, you're
Sirat.
Okay.
So it's from U.S. Tiny OC Bible that he gave to Paul a long time ago, many chapters ago when you were still alive. But, you know, now that we're far off of that, he brings it open and he talks about this quote that I wanted to provide the proper context to. And in order to do that, you must know what Sirat is. So according to Islamic belief, As-Sirat is a bridge that spans over the chasm of hell and connects the world to paradise, right? And supposedly the bridge is like thinner than a strand of hair and sharper than the sharpest blade. So I guess that hurts and it's really hard to cross. Mm-hmm. So it kind of puts into context when Paul says, paradise on my right, hell on my left, and the angel of death behind. As like, they're like, as he's like looking at everything, the whole
when he's scanning his surroundings, right?
Mm-hmm. Seeing the landscape around him.
But that bridge you were talking about, it's basically telling everybody to go to hell because it's literally impossible to cross. Like if you try to attempt to cross it, you have to go across the entire chasm, which I imagine to be humongous, on a scale untold.
Right. I mean, on a different note, it's also bit of foreshadowing, I'd imagine, because later Kynes's dream is mentioned, which is that the entirety of Arrakis will become a paradise. And I mean, they could achieve paradise, but it's a very delicate bridge to cross, and so it'll be very difficult.
And, sacrifice a lot.
Yeah, so that's why they mentioned. I mean, generally when you think of paradise, you know, you think of this paradise landscape that, you know, that's kind of the general idea. And here, of course, is very symbolic. Yeah.
I mean, when you think about paradise, what do you think about? Like the Caribbean?
I think about paradise when I don't have to do college applications anymore. That's paradise.
That's true.
Yeah, I just, my paradise is just like sitting there and being able to appreciate the fact that I could sit there and like feel fulfilled without having to do anything.
Indeed. Yeah, true.
My paradise is doing nothing.
Burnout symptoms showing.
Yeah,
guys.
Indeed. Yeah. It's only September. It's only September. Yeah.
Yeah, it's only been 3 weeks since school started.
Yeah, that's okay. Actually really crazy. But anyway.
Okay, so back to the book. Chani hands Paul some leaf wrapped morsels, which is basically the Fremen version of food. And the only thing that I could like think of or like tie it back to in the real world is the Chinese Junzi. So, because that's like wrapped in banana leaves, and I might be just biased because I actually don't know any other food wrapped in leaves from our world. So, do y'all know anything like that it could resemble other than junzi?
Nolan, I think you're very biased because have you ever heard of a tamale?
Oh, wait, hold up. Wait, is that a leaf?
No, it's like the Mexican food where they wrap like the beef and I think there's some rice in there in like that leaf. I don't know what it's called, but It's like some Mexican food like that. And then there's also in Korean culture, they have something called the sam, where you wrap up foodstuffs like meat and vegetables and cabbage.
That's true,
Or
but I
like
think the
lettuce, I don't
some
know.
I thought some wouldn't apply because like Chinese seems to be using it as like a preservation, while like in the some is just used because it tastes really nice, no?
Yeah, I guess that's true, but did he also eat the leaf in the book?
Oh, I don't, bro,
I don't know. They never mentioned it.
Yeah,
They
maybe.
never mentioned it.
I'm not sure. But it also reminds me, I said a real world examples of lembas bread from Tolkien, but
Yeah.
that's also pretty far-fetched. One is a mythological bread, and this is just some stinking
Match.
spice, right? So,
Well, I think tamales matches the description very
yeah, I
well.
think probably, yeah,
That's
tamales,
true.
yeah.
Yeah, I think tamales do match it really well. Okay, so now we get to Jessica's quote, which happens to be my quote as well. So here she goes like, "I must suppress such longings," she thought. "They're a weakness. I no longer can afford weaknesses." So this is like a callback to the epigraph's word Spannungsbogen, because Jessica is exercising some of the Spannungsbogen here as she is trying not to think of all the things that she misses back on Caladan. Honestly, though, like, it's this very little thing that makes Jessica sad, and I guess that's true because in this case, it's like Jessica lamenting about the fact that she'll never see a rainbow again. She's like, "Oh no, never again, because
Never
it never
again.
rains here, I guess." I
Indeed.
think it makes sense, you know, because like when you're too busy guarding yourselves from like sadness, you only think about like the major factors, because you know like those factors would make you like absolutely upset, so you can't expect that. However, it's always like the small things that catches us, because there's too many of them. There's too unpredictable, and these instances will catch us off guard and just slip through our defense sometimes. So very sad stuff.
Right, but Jessica is right in, starting to exercise this Spannungsbogen. So we were always talking about how the last two chapters she seemed to be far too distracted by things in the past to kind of focus on her mission of getting Paul to the Fremen, getting herself to the Fremen, and figuring out where to go from there, right? So it's good that she's realizing. And again, I don't want to seem like a heartless monster and say she shouldn't feel any emotion at all, because of course she just lost her. Technically, still her
She lost
boyfriend, but
everything.
yeah. So, and yeah, she just basically lost everything. Of course, it's even painful for an emotionally controlled Bene Gesserit. But
Yeah,
yeah,
it's not an easy thing to get
it's not.
through.
Yeah, but it's. I mean, her situation is not easy, so she needs to deal with what's going
Yeah,
on too. Yeah.
definitely. Okay, so Stilgar points out proper druses in the basin to Jessica. I think that's how you pronounce it. And I
Yeah,
was
that's
really
how
confused about what this meant, so I Googled
I
it, and it means a rock cavity lined with a crust of projecting crystals. And I think
Okay.
in this case, Herbert is just referring to the rock cavity because there wasn't a description of crystals within the basin. But
Most likely. Yeah. Was
Yeah,
it
most
a
likely.
few chapters ago when Idaho and Stilgar and Leto were all in a room, was it mentioned that they lived in these druses, or was it mentioned that they lived underground? I cannot remember.
I thought they lived underground,
Yeah,
right?
that's
Well,
what
I don't
I.
know. I know they lived in caves.
Yeah. I mean, I suppose depending on the way you see it, caves is underground.
Okay, so the word druses actually came up earlier, I think, when Paul was having his visions.
Oh, really?
Yeah, I think I mentioned that he saw people in druses and whatnot, but like,
Okay, we totally missed that then. Oh,
yeah.
interesting. Yeah, so I guess they've always, just lived in these cutout holes. Yeah.
Right.
Interesting. We gotta live in this desert.
Yeah, that's how they live, right?
So now we see that Stilgar and Jessica are having this little talk between them, and Stilgar is, we know, is a leader of this tribe, and how he defines the leader and how they become the leader is that they have to be the strongest one, and it's based on the criteria of water and security, right? So not just anybody can step in and fill this role. However, Jessica obviously can guide the tribe in finding water through how just insanely smart she is. And we also saw that Jessica is definitely able to best the strongest of the Fremen because she bested Stilgar. But the problem is that even though he gave that criteria, he didn't mention the other criteria. And the other criteria is that Jessica is just inherently not of the sand. And that means like she's not from the desert. And it shows in her movements, posture, and her like way of thinking. Also like her abilities because she's Bene Gesserit.
Right.
So the Fremen were like, in this case, even though she is the best around, other than Paul maybe, they'll still prefer someone who understands the way of the desert and how they've lived, because That's like a massive distinction that's practically unattainable unless you've lived there for almost your entire life and you grew up with like the unique Fremen ways of like moving and like living. It's so unique that you can't like replicate it really.
Yeah, I agree that Jessica is indeed very strong, and like you said, she doesn't know the way of the desert. So I think that Paul will actually eventually lead the Fremen because he naturally knows their ways, and now that he's integrated with them, he'll learn even more.
Yeah, I mean, Paul definitely has some sense for the ways of the desert, but it's a bit interesting that he still needs to be told a lot of things by Chani. So it's not just that he has an instinct or something like that for everything, and he still needs to learn things, and probably just has some inherited Fremen abilities or whatever. Yeah, but lots of things for him to learn and for him to improve on. So again, good no OP protagonist, right? That
Yeah, I want to see that character development.
indeed,
Yeah, I want to see how much Chani can teach him.
And now we get to a shocking truth, which is the real reason why that there aren't any satellites above Arrakis.
Oh
And that's
yeah,
because,
this was so weird.
yeah, it was a pretty big reveal, because the reason is that the Fremen are actually bribing the guild with monstrous amounts of spice. Yeah,
Ooh, yeah.
that was quite the description, to be honest. And we know how expensive the guild is, so I really can't imagine how much they're demanding.
Just shoveling tons and tons of
Yeah,
spice.
mountains and mountains of spice, maybe. I don't know. And at this point, you may be wondering, why would they do this? But the answer is it's simpler than you would think. It's to keep their movement secret so that the Harkonnens or whoever's trying to invade Arrakis, unaware that they're trying to make Arrakis fit for life.
Yeah, I mean, it's an interesting thing to hide, though, right? I can't really see it because I'm not sure why the Fremen go to such pains to hide that they're trying to make Arrakis fit for life. It's not like the Harkonnens are going to waste their time by coming into the Sieges and just cutting down all their plants. Like, ha, there goes a tree. Ha, there goes some grass. I mean, it's th there's they've got better things to do. More like, ha, there goes a Fremen, right? That's what they're trying to do. So the Fremen's enemies are targeting the Fremen, and they're not targeting Arrakis as a planet, right? So there's a few theories that I have. So perhaps if they make this planet a biosphere, it'll reduce dependence on the spice, and the Fremen want to reduce their dependence because I mean, I feel like they would know just as we know that the spice is a poison, right? And they might want to wean off of it, perhaps. And so when the desert is gone, probably the spice will be gone, right? And another theory I have is perhaps it's to mask the Fremen's technological advancements so that they can actually do all this, and the Fremen want to try to keep everything under wraps, maybe. So, but either way, it's still really hard to comprehend their
Why they
exact
would keep it
motive.
hidden.
Yeah. So, and I
It
mean,
seems like a lot of trouble, yeah.
we don't really, I mean, I don't really have any super, tangible evidence for these theories, but yeah,
Well,
some
I can
things to
kind of
keep in
give an
mind.
explanation as to why they would want to hide it. Because we already know that the Fremen and Harkonnens are not in a good relationship. So, like, why would they? So, whenever they would just break down anything that the Fremen have, like, once they find out, they would probably just get in their way just to be petty.
Oh, also, yeah, the Fremen are hiding large stores of water in order to do this because they're like trapping the water from somewhere and they're basically able to use it on plant life. But also, the fact is that, like, remember the Imperium testing stations all throughout Dune? I think if they revealed that they were able to successfully like work off of like past, I guess, experiments, or like they took control of the Imperium like testing stations in order to conduct their own lab stations, it would probably upset a lot of people. But also, it would just reveal that there is hope like for Arrakis, and that's probably, depending on which side you are, you probably don't want the Fremen to have too much hope in overthrowing their
Oh
like, current conditions.
yeah,
right. Yeah,
they don't
hope.
want a rebellion to
Hope
happen.
is a dangerous drug. Yeah, so that true. Yeah, those are really great theories too. Yeah, very cool. I think we just need to keep that in mind as to why they're so secretive, right? Because to be honest, they are a really secretive society, and we just don't know much about them. If we weren't in the heads of Fremen, we wouldn't know much about them.
Honestly.
Yeah, I mean, even in their heads, it's hard to tell what they're
Yeah,
thinking.
honestly, yeah. I mean, can't really understand still, and just makes it even more clear how secretive they are.
And now that we have gotten to my quote, I will read it again. It goes, "They grow," he said, "but the slow way is the safe way." And I want to restate again, please do not take that out of context. But I thought that the way Herbert worded it was quite fitting for this situation, because So there, to give some context, they were talking about the bribe of the Spacing Guild and how it'll increase over time.
Yeah.
And but I think that even though it'll cost more and more to bribe the guild, the process of converting the planet, like, it'll be worth it for them. Because once they make Arrakis into a livable planet, they won't have to worry about anything like bribing or like fighting the Harkonnen, maybe.
Right. I mean,
I think they can win in a perfect environment.
Right.
Yeah, in a perfect environment. But I mean, if the bribes keep growing, that means the Fremen are basically racing against time to achieve their dream. Because if the bribes
That
keep
is
growing,
true.
at one point they'll, you know, it'll meet their production limits and they won't be able to produce anymore, right? And I mean, we haven't seen ex how much exactly they're trying to convert, like how exactly they're trying to convert 3% of Arrakis into greenery, but and carbon producing life. But I mean, we'll probably see more plans once we get into the siege and once we become more familiar with the people.
Right. And we also don't know if spice is a non-renewable or a renewable resource.
Oh yeah, we've just like run out.
Yeah. What if it's like oil?
Now that you think about it though, like how did the Fremen even harvest the spice? Because from what we can tell, I don't get the impression that Fremen have like this large machinery lying around. We do know that Fremen can operate it because we've seen them do it while like they infiltrated Atreides and Arcanines. But it just seems like outlandish to think that they just have massive fleets of their own spice gathering machinery. Otherwise, they would have been caught a long time ago by the Harkonnens or the Atreides.
Right. So I'm not sure, but I'm guessing their methods have to be extremely efficient to, well, to pay off such a large bribe from the guild. But they're also they so my guess is that they found a way to collect directly from the source, and that would explain why they don't need complex machinery to collect them from the surface of the planet.
Yeah, I
Yeah,
mean,
if
I'm
you
sure
think
they have
about it,
their
yeah.
own methods that can beat those of the Atreides and Harkonnens, because the Harkonnens must have noticed the guild, you know, taking down all the satellites, and they must have tried to counter bribe the guild to put them back up once they realized the guild was being bribed to take them down, right? And this would mean that the Fremen are outpaying the Harkonnens essentially, and we know how much spice the Harkonnens have, right? So it must be it must be, you know, they must have a massive stockpile. They must have some really efficient way to get that spice.
They just spent 60 years of it on the Sardaukar, so they're kind of in the
I
they're in the
mean,
red.
yeah, they're red and dead. So we get a mirage here in the desert, Jessica sees. So here it's the Fremen riding on the backs of the Makers, which are the sandworms themselves.
Yeah, but like I don't really understand why Jessica suspects that it's like a real image because from my understanding, a mirage is just fake, right? Because I mean, wait, the truth is I don't really understand how mirages work. But my understanding is that like a mirage is like a reflection or something they see on the desert and like you're just hallucinating or like you're delirious. So I don't really understand when I read it why Jessica thinks she seemed like the real thing.
Well, mirages happen when light passes through two layers of air with different temperatures.
Oh, okay. That's our
So
science
basically, when
lesson.
the desert sun heats the sand, it turns the air above it like very, it just like heats it, right? So there's gonna be like, it's, and the hot air bends the light rays that and reflects the sky. So when you see it from a distance, the different air masses colliding with each other act like a mirror.
Interesting.
But I'm not entirely convinced that what you saw was a mirage, and I think it's some sort of foreshadowing.
Yeah,
Oh, okay.
same. I'm thinking foreshadowing too. It's like maybe a vision in disguise or somewhat. You know, we know these Ben Jesuits are so prophetic and everything.
Just
So
get hit.
yeah, so they get smacked with these visions, right? And,
I mean, we've already heard about Fremen's hooking onto worms, so I wouldn't be surprised if this is a real thing.
Yeah, I
We
mean,
got
but
introduced to like the
I mean, they
hooks.
even mention it later in the chapter.
Right. Yeah, they do. So, I mean, she's probably not 100% hallucinating. There's definitely something more to it.
So now she goes and they get into the Bef they're like she's talking with Stilgar outside on the like I don't know their little rock thing, their little druce. So I don't know. This is like whoa. I don't really like where the character relationship between Jessica and Stilgar are heading because like thinking about it objectively, Jessica does have to consider that Stilgar is in I guess not interested like romantically, but is interested in the fact that they can make a powerful deal by getting together, and she does have her children and the unborn daughter to think about. But I also don't really understand why she has this whole mental struggle of choosing whether to give birth to like her daughter or not in the face of death, Because she sounds like she could just say no and she won't actually just have the baby at all. Which I'm not really, I don't think that's how biology works with sure, Jessica.
She well, can just force I mean, an abortion.
Yeah.
No need I don't, for like, Planned I don't Parenthood. Understand how she's going to do that.
Yeah. It's the desert, yeah. I mean, the Bene Gesserit have such fine control over their body. I mean, there's probably some way for that to happen. But
yeah,
I mean, I mean, these people aren't, yeah, apoptosis, but these people aren't, you know, aren't normal human beings, right? So of course, yeah, normal humans can't just, you know, just will an abortion.
But still, like, it doesn't explain, like, it doesn't explain why she's so worried about her, like, her not existing anymore, because she's like, technically, Pa is from her. So even if she doesn't have the daughter, Pa can still carry on her lineage. So if she happens to die without burning Saint Ilya of the Knife, it's not like she's entirely disappeared from the world because she's Pa. So I don't really understand the whole like seeking immortality through progeny that she's talking about.
Well, I think you misunderstood what she meant when she said face with death, because she's trying to say that it's a natural thing to seek immortality through progeny, which is, I guess, like give birth to an offspring. Like
reproduction, yeah.
Yeah, yeah. So it's basically like face with death is talking about mortal beings, like anything that's alive wants to create offspring to like pass on their genetics or something.
Mm-hmm.
So I think what you were thinking about is like, oh, she's about to die and she needs to give birth right before she dies, which isn't exactly the case. It's like, oh, she already asked Paul to carry on her legacy, but she also needs to give birth to Saint Ilya of the Knife.
Mm-hmm. Right.
Yeah.
I also think that the Bene Gesserit have some perhaps sort of foreboding with their children, because the Bene Gesserit children tend to be very special, and we as readers already know that Saint Ilya of the Knife will be very influential later on as Paul's sister, of course, because Paul is of course very influential, and the mother's influential, father's influential. I'd be surprised if fate lets her loose, right? So I wouldn't be surprised if Jessica has some sort of, you know, premonition of the same.
This child has codes a lot of promise, so I can see why Jessica wants to keep it. Mm-hmm. It's still weird though how, I don't know, Herbert's trying to pull a relationship between Jessica and Stilgar together though. That's my opinion.
Like, I don't know. I don't think they match that well. Yeah, but
I don't see the chemistry there.
But I mean, they don't see it either. Jessica.
Honestly.
Yeah, they don't see it either. So I mean, good for them.
Yeah. Good direction. At least they have good logic.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so we get the Fremen word for Reverend Mother, which is Sayadina, and it's just something that I wanted to keep in mind.
Right. Yeah, it's really interesting that the Fremen call the priests of their religion Reverend Mothers. You know, so it's more of the missionaria influence going around here, right? So
yeah,
something else to keep in mind. Just another example of that. And
yeah,
also,
I don't think they're actually like the same. Like, I don't think they're the same power level as an actual Reverend Mother. I think they just like messed up the terminology of
it,
to be honest.
I believe so. I don't believe that the Fremen actually know, you know, that I actually know about the Bene Gesserit and everything. So they just, you know, the Bene Gesserit came and proselytized them, I suppose. Yeah.
Yeah.
And a quick Google search reveals that this word Sayadina is actually more Chicopsa. So it seems like it's quite the prevalent language around here. So something else to keep in mind. So
wait, do you think of communicating? Like, do you think Chicopsa is like their main language and that Jessica just naturally understands it? And do you think that Paul, when he communicates, is he using Chicopsa or is he like communicating with whatever?
I believe they're using like some, I believe that they're using the form of standard language like English, right? And then like Chicopsa is something perhaps that the Fremen use amongst themselves or when they need to use it, because Chicopsa is a hunting language and I feel like the Fremen you know, are more hunters. Yeah. And
I can see that.
Right. So we reach my quote for the week and here goes. A leader, you see, is one of the things that distinguishes a mob from a people. He maintains the level of individuals. Too few individuals and a people reverts to a mob. So it's, I think, really cool to see Stilgar's philosophy of leadership here and how it's pretty similar to Duke Leto's philosophy, I think, because these are the two leaders that we know the best. And they both treat individuals with high importance because Leto wants to make sure that he was respected and loved by all, and Stilgar makes sure that each person maintains their independence, right? And Stilgar is right here, and he's able to separate the people from the mob and make sure that they maintain their common purpose and they don't fight amongst each other to slow each other down. And this is in pretty big contrast to the Baron, who, can't control. Technically, they're not really his subordinates, the Sardaukar, but he can't, force them to do anything. And then he's also having trouble controlling his own subordinates and all that. And he has to hire, mercenaries and whatever. And, so it's pretty big contrast to the other negative light leader, in the book.
I think also just like the way that Stilgar rules means that he puts a lot of respect for the individuals that are like his subordinates because he shows that he values them a lot. And just like having people that like are capable and reliable and like loyal just really builds a good strong community around around their whole like taking care of the tribe mentality. I think that really contributes to protecting each other and sacrificing for the greater good. Otherwise, if it was like a bad leadership, then like they'd be less inclined to sacrifice their own water or like their own like efforts for the rest of like the good of the tribe. You know what I mean?
Right.
And what you said about how his philosophy is like similar to Duke Leto's, I think that's why he showed respect to him by like, I guess, spitting at him, which isn't the traditional way of showing
Yeah,
respect,
but
but on
on
Arrakis, it's a big
Arrakis,
deal.
yeah, you're losing water out here, that's
Exactly.
yep.
We also get a sense of Stilgar's ability to keep his mind straight and objective in many of the scenarios and just not following his primal desires of like, I don't know, reproduction. So I think the biggest problem that I have here is that like I'm perplexed on why Jessica thinks like Stilgar's wisdom and discipline is like a genetic trait because she's like, wait, what did she say? Like, what is his ancestry? Whence comes such breeding? She said. And I was just like, why? Like, why does she think it's like ancestry? Why does she think it's like breeding? Because I'm confused on whether it's just like a Bene Gesserit way of thinking that quality traits can only be bred into a person, which in my opinion just means that they support what the old royals wanted to do, which is inbreeding, or is it just like Herbert's understanding of genetics back in the 60s? I don't really understand this part.
Is Jessica secretly a social Darwinist?
Ooh,
Oh my God, is she? Ooh,
definitely
I'm
a
just kidding.
Darwinist.
I'm just kidding.
Definitely.
But, well, at the same time, you still have to remember that in Dune, in the Dune world, pedigree means quite a lot. Like, one of the
That's
reasons
true.
why Paul is so talented is because he has the blood of the Atreides, Harkonnen, and the Bene Gesserit.
Right. Yeah, I mean, it seems to be a standard trope with fantasy and sci-fi that bloodline is the defining trait in a sense, and that you're defined by your ancestry. And a lot of the times it's just people fighting against their ancestry that makes a story, and that's basically just fighting fate in a sense. But a lot of the times it's in their own
Yeah,
head. So it's a really interesting thing, how much
it's on her
bloodline
head.
matters, yeah.
But here we also get some interesting bits on Stilgar talking about the religion inside of sieges. So Stilgar re releases the affiliation of the Bene Gesserit, or at least the Reverend Mother in the Fremen world, to God. So I take it that though the Bene Gesserit use and analyze teachings of wisdom from many other faiths, they may be more closely affiliated with Christianity, or maybe, I don't know. I don't think that might be entirely true, or like if this thinking is like right, because knowing the Missionaria Protectiva, it could like draw a parallel to like the whole Spanish conquest of natives in the New World, and we know that the missionaries, whether intentionally or not, enforce imperialistic influence over the natives using God as like a justification for oppression. So I'm not sure when he says God or like the Lord, if he means like Christian God, or it's just like him referring to whatever they were taught by the Missionaria Protectiva.
Well, isn't the Muad'Dib basically God to the Fremen?
I
Or,
guess, yeah.
yeah.
Like a
And,
savior, you know, yeah.
And we know that the Kwisatz Haderach is kind of like God to the Bene Gesserit. Or it's like who they're supposed to like worship, I
Yeah,
guess.
the worship, yeah.
And so they basically worship the same person, which is Paul. And so I'm not sure why there would be like oppression or whatever if their religions are basically the same thing.
Yeah, well, I'm not sure if the Bene Gesserit worship the Kwisatz Haderach so specifically, because from what I can see, they treat the Kwisatz Haderach as another tool just to, you know, further the Bene Gesserit purpose.
Yeah,
also, also, I'm not sure that capital G God necessarily refers to the Christian faith, and there's probably, you know, a lot of monotheistic religions out there, because I'm not a super like studious theologist, but I know that there's definitely some other religions that use capital G God to refer to their respective deities. And for all we know, the Fremen invented a totally new Iraqi religion, right? That on their own.
Yeah, that's what I think. I suspect it's just like their own weird little like syncretism of whatever they have been told and whatever their traditional like before faith was.
Because it's so interesting that for such a strong warlike tribe, they were so easily, well, I don't know if easily, but they were so proselytized, right? By
I was just like, how did they get beat by the missionary?
I mean, the missionary are wild. I mean, they have their own wiles, right? But yeah,
even so, like, it's too much.
Yeah, it's a lot to
suspicious.
Do. Yeah, it is. So yeah, so I mean, this is probably going to be a pretty difficult discussion, but I want to read the prophecy that Jessica recites to Stilgar, as it'll give context for our discussion here. So it goes, Ibn Qurtaiba, she said, as far as the spot where the dust ends. She stretched out an arm from her robe, seeing Stilgar's eyes go wide. She heard a rustling of many robes in the background. I see a Fremen with the Book of Examples, she intoned. He reads to Allah, the son whom he defied and subjugated. He reads to the saddest of the trial, and this is what he reads. Mine enemies are like green blades eaten down that did stand in the path of the tempest. Hast thou not seen what our Lord did? He sent the pestilence among them that did lay schemes against us. They are like birds scattered by the huntsman. Their schemes are like pellets of poison that every mouth rejects. Yeah, interesting.
So much.
Yeah, it's a lot. It's a pretty long chunk. And let's break this down. So she starts with this thing called Ibn Qurtaiba. It seems like it's derived from Arabic, but a quick Google search reveals that it's not. So, I mean, we were instantly misled at the very beginning. But she says this Book of Examples, which there's not much text evidence, so we'll skip over that, but that's really interesting. So there's this Fremen reading to Allat. So Allat is actually some North Arabian goddess in real life. But I don't think Allat is it's not the same Allat, right? It seems more like Apollo. They both start with an A, I guess, and have two L's. But it's like the sun. And also this thing called Saddis of the Trial, which I'm not so sure what it is. But since this Fremen is reading to both of them at the same time, they might be the same entity, right? Moving on into the bulk of the poem here, mine enemies are like green blades beaten down that did stand in the path of the tempest. So we speculate that the tempest would be Paul. Kind of terrible purpose, and the enemies are the people that Paul, using his abilities, just mows down, right? And I mean, and mows down
mainly
is,
the Harkonnens.
Yeah, mows down is especially appropriate because it's green blades, like green blades of grass. Right? And hast thou not seen what our Lord did? So, I mean, perhaps the Lord that, you know, because the Fremen essentially worship Paul like the Lord, so it's, you know, basically their God. And he sent the pestilence among them that did lay schemes against us. So again, keeping with he being Paul, it would be this person, you know, Paul would send this pestilence or this, you know, terrible things to the Harkonnens that still go against the Fremen.
This is yet to happen, but it will.
Right. They are like birds scattered by the huntsman, they being the Harkonnens. I think that's pretty straightforward. Their schemes are like pellets of poison that every mouth rejects. So perhaps Paul will be able to bring some new form of, some new form of understanding to the Fremen.
And maybe it'll be like they'll turn on the Harkonnens and other people will follow them, like the Landsraal maybe actually turn on them too.
Right.
So he's gonna bring unite everyone together as like a common force to go against the Harkonnen. Maybe even the Imperium too, because the Imperium was backing the Harkonnens at a certain point.
It's true.
Yeah, perhaps. I mean, yeah, it's a really complicated poem, I must say. It
Yeah.
was hard to understand the beginning, and
It took a lot of analysis.
yeah, it took us a while to kind of come up with that. I mean, we had an idea it would be Paul and the Harkonnens, but it was hard to kind of fit it in, and it still doesn't fit quite perfectly. It's like trying to fit a square peg into a circle, right? But
Right.
we're trying our best. You know, we're slowly whittling down that square peg to make it fit into the circle.
Honestly.
Indeed, yeah. So this may not be an accurate interpretation. We'd love to hear. If there's no spoilers, of course, we'd love to hear anyone else's interpretation. So feel free to shoot us an email there. But that's just our best guess with the knowledge that we have, right? Cool.
But this entire process of like Jessica reciting this entire thing off of, what does she call it? She calls it like the Dar al Hikman thing. Like, is that like a trained thing to do? Because she was like, I know this feeling. We've trained for it. And then she just suddenly starts spurting out all these phrases, right? This ability to just like pop off and just prophesize on the spot. Is that like a Bene Gesserit prepare their lives for? But that's like so shady because like, how would they ever know if it becomes true? Like, she just talked about all this. Like, we're gonna be paying attention in the next like. And the rest of this book to make sure that this is like actually happening, and the Fremen are gonna put her to that test too, because that's what they're looking for when they're like testing if she is like the Reverend Mother or whatever, or if they're or like if they're the Bene Gesserit with the son that will save them. So like, it seems that everyone else, however, they do know what to say after Jessica says it, because like she's like the fire of God mount over thy heart, and then the response that came from like the Fremen watching was like the fire of God set alight. So they do know the ceremonial words to say, and somehow Jessica also knows, even though she's just like been here for the first day. And I find it so weird. Like, I don't know. Like, how does Jessica know? Like, I don't like this is overpowered, kind of. Like, she's just profiling their entire religion all in one sitting.
Honestly, I was so confused as well because I was thinking, is this a real prophecy or not? Because it's not natural for someone to just randomly spout lines like this, but at the same time, she feels sort of guilty about it, meaning that somehow she could have made it up on the spot.
It's probably made up, Like, I feel like she's following like a template or something, just like twisting it every now and then, depending on her profiling.
I believe that. I'm not so sure it's made up, but I mean, and also I don't think she feels necessarily guilty, but it's mentioned she feels bitter, right? But it's more like she's taken advantage of the Fremen and manipulated them to further her own needs and Paul's needs, and you know, to keep, you know, continuing this Bene Gesserit purpose, right? And yeah, and even though this Adab wasn't really scripted, it's clearly been etched into the Fremen religion somewhat because they've been looking for this sign. And given they knew how to respond, you know, I think that kind of supports my claim. And this probably was part of the Bene Gesserit training too, somehow. There's probably some set phrases or somewhat to, you know, to that the Missionaria plant and then come back and teach the Bene Gesserit so that the Bene Gesserit know how to utilize these foundations
Activate.
among these indigenous people that are laid by the Missionaria. And that's, you know, it's really interesting how elaborate this whole scheme is, because the Missionaria, you know, implanted this whole religion just for Jessica to be using here, right?
This is
Yeah.
so unethical on so many levels, but
I
I mean, I
mean,
guess she's protecting herself and Paul.
yeah, in a way she's also furthering the purpose of the Fremen alongside,
Yeah, I
you
mean,
know.
it might pay off
It's
to be
weird.
honest,
It might,
so.
yeah. So we can't judge too quickly. Yeah, I feel like.
That's true. It's like one of those lies that may be like a good lie in the end. I don't know.
Yep, right. I mean,
I mean, ends well, all's well, all's well, ends well.
yeah.
Okay, but the weirdest thing is that while Jessica is reciting this weird prophecy that may or may not be made up, Paul is experiencing some weird trinocular visions from that big spice bundle that he just ate from Chani. He sees the past, the present, and the future, which is quite interesting, this whole like ability to see three things all at once in your vision. I know Jessica and like the Reverend Mother discuss how the female Bene Gesserit can only view this in one direction, and I presume it's the future because their whole soothsaying thing and being able to like prophesize for the future. But I remember they said that the male Bene Gesserit, the special thing about them is that they have the ability to look in the other direction, which I guess in this case I believe is to be past and present, right? So I think this conceptualization of time and space for Paul is described so weirdly because the reader is kind of overwhelmed by trying to like wrap their head around how Paul sees it, and in a way that kind of directly matches with Paul's sense of being overwhelmed by all the information that he's getting. So Herbert just like ties it nicely together. We're like, we're confused, and so is Paul. So we kind of understand Paul. It's like, okay.
Right. Yeah.
I don't know. This was so confusing, to be honest. I had to read it like 3 times.
Yeah, I mean,
just repeatedly read it. I was like, what?
Yeah, I still don't quite understand it, but I wanted to highlight a little part that I have some theories of, and we'll keep discussing this this time flow. But Paul describes as uncertainty of the flow of time using this analogy that of the Heisenberg's uncertainty principle. So for all those non-theoretical physicians, physicists. Yeah, I keep getting those confused, right? Physicists. This principle essentially states that one cannot know both the position and velocity of any particle or object simultaneously. So essentially, if an object is, you know where it is, you can't know where it's going, essentially. So,
right.
So one of these, you know, position or velocity is always uncertain. And Paul uses this principle to describe how, though he feels that he understands his prescience and the various paths he could end up in, his every minuscule action would shift the visions far too dramatically to gain any form of certainty from them. So it's at the same time as certain and uncertain, because at every infinitesimally small point of time, and you know, Paul is thinking very fast, so he's, you know, essentially thinking at a interval of time so small that it's negligible. You know, it seems like everything is set in stone, but then, you know, his arm twitches or some grain of sand falls from the ceiling into an inch away from where it was supposed to land, and boom, everything is just entirely different. Yeah, and then and not necessarily even a reprocess, because I feel like his brain is fast enough to just show, right? But it's just not. Yeah, so it's just really crazy to think about. I mean, just imagine how much data that is. That's, you know, exabytes and yottabytes and zettabytes of data right there. I don't even know if those are the correct metric prefixes, but yeah, that's really insane. Just all the futures and just continuously shift. It's just all this big data going in and out, right? That's just...
His brain's got to be moving faster than light speed at this point.
Oh, yeah, definitely. He's broken the light barrier.
He disproved Einstein's equation.
Yeah, don't even know, honestly, because I feel like electricity wouldn't travel fast enough for him. Like, for his mind.
I have this kind of a weird theory in this regard. It's just like, I was thinking, because Paul describes it as like this whole like time nexus concept, I wonder if it's just like the whole time nexus thing exists because of Paul, because Paul's such like an influential figure in the timeline. So in that regard, whatever he does is super influential to like the rest of the timeline, meaning whatever like infinitesimal like twitch or movement of the arm, it changes the entire timeline. So I was just like thinking, like, that's the reason why every piece of the time nexus goes back and ties into the cave, because Paul is there and he exists as like the convergence of the futures wherever Paul is, just because of how much impact he has in the past, present, and the future.
Right. I think it's really scary to think about the butterfly effect, because I mean, imagine kicking a small rock in the past, and when you travel back to the future, some random dude is now president and he makes an executive order to ban video games. Like, well, I mean, that's kind of an outlandish example, but you know what I mean. Like, the butterfly effect, it might be real, and Paul needs to be careful not to mess with anything that'll cause his future to be in danger.
But then again, if every decision affects everything, then is it really, you know, worth it to be thinking about that? Is it even a valuable ability? Like, because it's just, you know, just so indefinite. And I mean, it's what I think is a really interesting nerf to this future seeing concept, right? And I'm interested to see how Paul uses his powers, if at all. Will he use his powers? Because this is just so, you know, it feels so disorienting that he just keeps, you know, he's finally set on a vision, and then bang, everything just 180 degrees change, right? And then I mean, he'll probably just end up using his visions as a guide or some form of deja vu to guide him. But definitely I feel like in this current state, maybe he'll learn to harness his visions better, but in this current state, you know, nothing will be a definitive.
I don't know, it's just like he sees too much for any of it to be useful. That's kind of sad.
Yeah,
I think he just needs to like use it every now and then when it's actually useful, and like let it just go through it himself for most of it.
Right,
but like him going through it, does that change the timeline too, because he's taking seconds to look through it? I don't know.
Well, I mean, I think sometimes it's just better not to think about it.
Honestly, just do it. Nike logo.
Nike swoosh. Yeah, we're not
sponsor us.
Yeah, no, sponsor us, Nike. Indeed. Yeah. All right, yeah.
Okay, so now we're nearing the end of the chapter, and Herbert kind of leaves us off on a foreboding shadow of a dead paw in a thread of his time nexus. So I'm curious, do y'all think Herbert is good at cliffhangers? Because it doesn't quite feel as irritating as other cliffhangers that I've read in my life. And I think ending, like doing a cliffhanger as like a simple foreshadowing doesn't actually like leaves the reader on the actual like hanging on by a thread, like can't wait to see what's gonna happen. Like what, but then like they're interrupted, a whole action scene type of feeling that you're like deprived of in other cliffhangers.
Yeah, well, honestly, since Herbert spoils so much of the book and like his epigraphs and stuff, it's not really much of a cliffhanger because I'm pretty sure like in a earlier epigraph recounted by Princess Irulan, it referred to Paul being old. So I'm not
Oof,
too
I mean,
worried that he's
makes
gonna
sense.
die anytime soon. Correct me if I'm
Okay,
wrong
yeah.
though. Yeah,
Okay.
I mean,
I see Paul growing old,
I normally say I'm 200% sure that Paul won't die because, of course, he's the protagonist and there's not really much of a story without him. But since it's Herbert writing, I mean, no, I think I can safely drop that percentage to 20%. So I'm only 20% sure
yeah.
that Paul won't die.
No, but
And
watch there be like a massive plot twist. Paul dies and Jessica becomes the main
oh
character.
no, that would be really
Oh boy.
interesting. Right, yeah, but I mean, I just don't think that would happen. Yeah, but. Like
Yeah,
Jessica,
personally,
I mean
no.
Jessica just doesn't have the main character vibes, you know. Like she's
Yeah,
a,
she's a support character. I'm sorry.
yeah, she is a support, but she's a
She
support
even
main
labels
character.
herself. Yeah, she looks up labels herself as a support character to Paul too. She's like, I gotta teach him all this stuff. So like,
Yeah, and
okay, she's a
she's
teacher.
the Obi-Wan, right? Just like that. Yeah,
Yeah.
that's really funny. Right, cool. Yeah. On that note, I believe that concludes the discussion for this episode of the Do Not Enter podcast. Make sure to read the halfway through chapter 33, and we'll stop at quote, and in the middle of the last word, he pounced, end quote. I
Okay.
wonder what that could mean. And tune in next time when we discuss it. As always, thanks to all of you listeners for being patient with us and being interested in our thoughts. Follow us on Instagram at do not enter, Reddit u/do not enter, Twitter at do not enter, and email us at do not enter at gmail.com. That is DUNENOTENTER at gmail.com. Contact us with questions, feedback, or I think it's my turn. Kershin rec e, I guess.
Kershin Rekri.
Kershin Rekri. Yeah. Okay. Sounds good. We'll run out of permutations eventually and we'll actually have to say it. But so if we made any mistakes, please don't hesitate in letting us know, and we'll do our best to fix those in the upcoming episodes, especially our pronunciation. We need work, right? But give us a review on iTunes or Spotify. It only takes a few seconds of your time. Just go in and make an account if you don't already have one, and go to our show and click the 5-star button because that's the only one that exists. And
Of course.
this, the reason for this is twofold. It motivates us to continue creating new content and lets us know we're doing a good job, and also helps us move up the charts so that we can get our podcast to a wider variety of listeners and spread our love for Dune. Otherwise, that's about it. So have a great week, and we will see you all back very soon.
See you guys.
Bye, guys.